guys ever eat garbage?
Well, raccoon hasn't.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because we're lazy.
Yeah.
Please expound.
When you get hungry, you stop at the closest garbage can.
Even when fresh food is just around the corner?
Creatures of habit.
Yeah, a bad habit.
Why eat junk at night when you can go to Wendy's? We make everything fresh right when you order, like the classic double with cheese, spicy chicken sandwich, and 99-cent junior bacon cheeseburger.
Well, no more garbage for this raccoon. It's Wendy's or nothing.
I'll eat to that.
Me too.
Make it a Wendy's night and do what tastes right till midnight or later. Prices and participation may vary.
Welcome to Wendy's.
Yeah, hi. I'll have a number one combo meal.
Would you like Orlando, Las Vegas, Chicago, L.A., or Tampa with that?
Excuse me?
It's the Choose a Combo, Choose Your Destination sweepstakes from Wendy's and Coca-Cola. Choose your combo with fries, baked potato, side salad, Caesar side salad, or chili, and you can win a trip on Southwest Airlines.
Please fasten your seatbelt and taxi forward. Your number one for takeout.
Do combo choices, do what tastes right. At Wendy's, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Visit swavacations.com/Wendy's for details.
What's inside your Michigan International Speedway ticket this June? More NASCAR Nextel Cup racing action. It all starts Friday, June 16th with the ARCA RE/MAX Series Hans Group 200. Then Saturday, it's the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series Conway Freight 200. And Sunday, June 18th, is the ultimate Father's Day experience. The Nextel Cup 3M Performance 400, presented by Post-it Picture Paper, featuring NASCAR's top stars. Plus, you'll find plenty of fun and entertainment for the entire family. Enjoy the MIS Walk of Champions, fan hospitality, camping, free race pit access, and more. Get inside NASCAR Nextel Cup Racing at MIS. Order your tickets today by calling 800-354-1010 or visit racetickets.com. That's 800-354-1010 or visit racetickets.com. Good seats are still available for the 3M Performance 400, but they're going fast. Get inside NASCAR Racing at Michigan International Speedway.
With more choices in cruisers and cruiser accessories, now is the time to choose Suzuki. Take control of the boulevard, turning heads everywhere with the all-new Suzuki Boulevard M109R, the only power cruiser combining GSXR influence performance with modern style. Finish line power sports has it, including the full line of Suzuki Boulevard cruisers and accessories to make your cruising dreams a reality. Choose from a wide range of fuel-injected 2006 Suzuki Boulevards, including the M50 and classically styled C50 and C90. For open-road comfort and touring, there's the C50T and C90T. Check out the sleek, laid-back look of the S83, S50, and S40 Suzuki Boulevard cruisers, all designed for maximum performance and reliability. Come in today and choose your Boulevard at Finish Line Power Sports. Finish Line Power Sports' new location at 7 Mile and Middle Belt in Livonia is now open. Their showroom is stocked and their friendly staff is ready to meet all your needs. Call today at 248-476-4400 or visit finishlinepowersports.com for more details. Read your owner's manual and please ride safely. Always wear a helmet and protective riding apparel.
Numbers have many meanings. Some people say it takes two to tango. Others say three's a crowd. Many think seven is a lucky number. But at Health Alliance Plan, we found a new way to use the number one. Introducing Solo, powered by HAP. Solo is affordable and flexible health coverage for individuals and families. Whether you're graduating from college, self-employed, between jobs, retiring early, or just want better coverage for your loved ones, a solo plan from HAP can give you what you want. Comprehensive plan designs include PPO options, health savings accounts, online enrollment, and above all, prices that fit your budget. So if you're looking for a great healthcare plan, go solo and get powered by HAP today. You can learn more and apply for solo at www.hap.org. That's www.hap.org. Solo products are offered through Alliance Health and Life Insurance Company, Inc., a wholly owned subsidiary of Health Alliance Plan.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Starting a little late, about 6 minutes after the hour here in Detroit, where we're broadcasting from. Welcome to everyone that's listening to WRIF on the airwaves, 101.1. And to all of you listening on the Internet across the country, across the world, a pleasure to be with you. If you want to join the conversation, 313-298-WRIF, like in Frank. And you can email me always at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And, you know, I wanted to talk about this death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and everything it suggests and some of the odd stuff about it, but I keep having this feeling. Sometimes when I get email from people who say they've heard the show for the first time and they can't understand why I'm so upset, or someone wrote and said I was obsessed with Bush and what have you. And I keep having this feeling that if you had a wonderful day-to-day like I did, I did a lot of stuff, had a grand time, had some nice meals out on our little, deck? It's not really a deck or whatever. Patio, I guess, bunch of stones, and just had a great day. Went out to breakfast and stuff like that, and you come home and watch the NBA finals and all that. And hey, what's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world? How could anybody complain? But it does seem to be increasingly fraying around our edges. Other places in the world, particularly in what at least used to be called the Third World, things are really quite miserable. And we know that. I mean, it's like people will quote the Bible where it says the poor have always been with us. Well, they've always been with us in class society when there's upper classes and lower classes. Most of the time, people lived a life of egalitarianism, equality. The Native American tribes, for instance. But you get to see other signs, and you begin to understand that people are suffering a lot of pain here as well. Not just economically. That's happening. That's certainly happening. But I came across a couple articles that really, I think, illustrated what's going on. And if you take the mass symptoms, nothing real bad's happening to me. Maybe nothing real bad is happening to you. Maybe your job, I don't know, whose job is secure? But maybe, like mine, my job, I think, is pretty secure. Doug Podell is our program director and the co-host of Motor City Riffs, and when he keeps telling people during the Motor City Riff show to listen to me, I always take that as a good sign. He plans on having me here the next week. But here, some of these other little just indices, as you would call them. Use of antipsychotics by the young rose fivefold. The use of potent antipsychotic drugs to treat children and adolescents for problems like aggression and mood swings increased more than fivefold in the 10 years between 1993 and 2002. And the researchers who did the survey found that antipsychotic medications were prescribed to almost 1,500 per 100,000 children and adolescents in 2002. And who knows? Who knows how much it's up? Because, there is this underlying current of fear, of terrorism, of bird flu, of climate change. I'm sorry. You say, why is this guy reminding me of all this? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about you, but those things occur to me from time to time, and for a lot of different reasons. Maybe I looked at the 10-day forecast and saw that it was going to be almost 90 again. Well, there's been other hot summers, but the whole idea of climate change, that new Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth, which started, suggests that we could be in some major problems along the line. So these things, even though I'm going out for a nice breakfast, I'm going for a nice walk with my wife and my dog, I'm doing a little work around the house, I'm sitting out in the back patio reading the New York Times and stuff like that, still, there's this background anxiety. Yeah, I know some of you probably think, I don't think about any of that. I don't know. So what is it? Maybe that, I don't know whether that's a more adaptable way. On the other hand, it sort of suggests that we don't have any power to intervene in any of this on our own, that we're just sort of helpless, and we might as well just let the anonymous forces, the anonymous political forces, the anonymous economic forces, the forces that are controlling things like the environment and what have you, that there's nothing we can do anyways, right? The old, you can't fight City Hall, so you might as well go for walks and sit on your patio and watch the NBA finals and what have you. I guess I don't, oh, I should have brought that. There was anybody has today's New York Times, get it, and go to this article about the different graduation speeches that that different people gave at different colleges. And on the, where it's continued, inside, there's a woman with a French name, Francine somebody or other, that has a little quote. Get it and read it to us. Somebody's got to have that. All right. So anyway, so you got more kids, five times what they were 10 years ago, taking antipsychotics. And who knows what's happened the last 4 years? Here's something else, something we really take for granted. This is an article from the Sioux City Journal. To you, that angry horn-blasting tailgater is suffering from road rage, but doctors have another name for it, intermittent explosive disorder. And man, how many people do we know that have that, or do we run into all the time? And oftentimes we react similarly, right? Someone's going to say, you know, they start honking, hey, drive much! And, of course, we react defensively, yelling at them, F you, man, you know, or slam on our brakes and stuff like that. But anyways, 16 million Americans suffer from this. So there's this fraying around the edges, and it all goes back to these polls that show at least three-quarters of us think we're headed off in the wrong direction. I think probably more aptly put, nobody knows what direction we're heading off in. I think that's it. There always was this sense of progress. In fact, you know, some of this language that I'm about to use that I got this, I'm trying to think if I'm I do have a website, don't I? Actually, I can look at it as we talk. It's peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com, WERBE.com. Yeah, it's a BBC documentary called The Power of Nightmares, The Power of Nightmares. And it's on my website. If you go to the first page and then over on the right here, I'm navigating it as we talk. It's there's a like a concert. It says all the songs, movies, videos, and the rest of popular culture that are bringing down the Bush crime family. Yeah, had to get a little. So now some of you are listening for the first time, know where I'm coming from. It's okay. I talk like this all the time, and you can talk similarly or the opposite by calling 313-298-WRIF. So the idea was that it was always upwards and onwards, and it was pretty much begun, depending on how old you are, with your generation or our parents' generation or our grandparents, that coming out of the exhilaration of the triumph of World War II. I mean, there was a horrible decade before that with the Depression. So the United States comes out pretty much unscathed, if you think of losing almost 500,000 men, unscathed, but not suffering the destruction that other parts of the world had. And there is this era of American hegemony, dominance, that we're calling the shots, and there's still an attempt to enforce that. In fact, that's really fraying around the edges as well. That's not working real well at all. The United States has problems beating irregular armies, as we saw in Vietnam. In fact, the only military triumphs, if you think about it, are ones with little teeny countries with no ability to resist, like Grenada in the 1980s, remember that, or Saddam in 1991, or Panama in 1989, those little exercises like that. Other than that, the United States does not do well, and we'll get on to that as well. 313-298-WRIF. Oh, yeah, The Power of Nightmares. Sorry. I really need my wife here because she, you know, I'm so all over the board all the time. She, you know, she keeps me on target. It used to be that the idea that there was this progressive notion of society that we were always improving, that technology was going to improve our health, that we were going to have more and more inventions to make life easier. Remember jetpacks for everybody and stuff like that. And also that we were going to eliminate poverty and stuff like that. Lots of stuff like that. Well, now, and politicians promised that. That's the premise of this BBC documentary. They would say, we are going to make life better for you, the American population, and by extension, the entire world. Things will get better. You will make more money than your parents. You will be healthier. You will live in a nicer, bigger house. We'll have more and more nicer suburbs and bigger cars and more gadgets and all of that. Well, now it looks like things are reversing. Not for all of us. Because remember, if you've listened to the program before, we talk about the model of Guatemala that's going to be universalized. So you're going to have this real steep class society with a third of us being well-waged, and some of you may know where you're at it, in it already. and others of you are very worried, particularly if you're working for an American corporation. So we'll wind up with a third doing what Americans have always done and thought things are okay and getting better. Two-thirds are going to have a pretty rough time of it. We may all have a rough time of it if the environment really goes south in terms of what that means, including getting hotter. So now, though, with the appearance of worldwide plagues like AIDS, the possibility of a worldwide plague like bird flu, terrorism being real and particularly, though, and mostly manipulated to engender fear, now politicians do not promise progress. They do not promise us the plentitude of life, but rather that they will protect us from our worst nightmare or our worst nightmares. So that is the power of nightmares. It's an interesting documentary. I would highly recommend it. All right. So 2 500-pound bombs land on Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Why didn't they attempt to capture him alive if they knew right where he was? It's kind of a isolated little building on the outskirts of things. I think could have surrounded him, maybe would have fought to the death. But they didn't do that. And here, though, is an extraordinarily interesting development. I don't know how far this has gone into the media. Well, first off, let me say this. You saw those photographs of him, right, with bruised face. Looked like somebody had been in a bad bar fight. Kind of, a lot of people have said he looked like the opera star Pavarotti. Pavarotti. But what I thought was the most unusual thing of all, that in less than a few hours, the body was photographed, the film was developed, and then it was blown up to a large size, and it was matted and framed for display. I mean, they have men in our, or women in our armed services, that's their deal? They mat and frame photographs? How odd that is, don't you think? Hey, join me at any time, by the way. I'm Peter Werby, this is Night Call, and our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. And this was in Iraq. And this is filed by Dexter Filkins and John F. Burns, both of them seasoned battlefield reporters for the New York Times. In the ruins of the palm-shaded home where Abu Musab al-Zarqawi spent his final moments lay the scraps of a life. The bits and pieces scattered Saturday through the ruins in Hibib were the remains of the American airstrike that killed Mr. Zarqawi. They call everybody Mr. They'd say Mr. Hitler, and five others Wednesday, when a pair of 500-pound bombs obliterated the brick house and left a crater 40 feet wide and deep. A crater 40 feet wide and deep. A big hole, sir, said Sergeant Major Gary Rimpley, 46 years old, of Penrose, Colorado, who reached the scene shortly after the bombing. On Saturday morning, the bodies were gone, including the body of a girl. The rubble had been picked over for most useful bits of intelligence. Even the crater had been mostly bulldozed and filled in. Along with the scraps, it was mostly questions that remained. Now, have these been everywhere? I've only seen this in the Times. Chief among them was how Mr. Zarqawi, the terrorist leader killed Wednesday in the airstrike, could have survived even for a few minutes after the attack, as American officers say he did when everything else around him was obliterated. Concrete blocks, walls, a fence, tin cans, palm trees, a washing machine, everything at the Hibib scene was shredded or blown to pieces. And they say in the Times as well, it seemed puzzling as well, given the destruction and condition of the other bodies, how Mr. Zarqawi's head and upper body, shown on televisions across the world, could have remained largely intact. So I don't know what to make of that. Although this certainly was much more seen by the Bush regime as a propaganda victory more than a military victory. And this is to get all the other aspects of political life for Bush and the Republicans off of the screens, if even for a few minutes. And there was a little uptick in Bush's popularity and his handling of the war. Now you say, wait a minute, Zarqawi led the insurgents, didn't he? No, not at all. He was an awful man that saw his mission in life, getting the word from God that he could kill civilians in pursuit of the goals that he saw to enforce a particular government on the nation of Iraq. You're talking about Zarqawi now, not Bush. Zarqawi. Well, I guess Bush too, eh? Now, here, this is from Will Bunch. Will Bunch writes in the New York Daily News, the Zarqawi PSYOP program, PSYOP psychological operation, the Zarqawi too many zoos in there, PSYOP program is the most successful information campaign to date. Now, Will Bunch says, who would say such an outrageous thing? And he says, try Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, who was the U.S. military's chief spokesman when the propaganda campaign in 2004. Now you're saying, wait a minute, what do you mean propaganda campaign? If you're going to debate the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and what it all means, you should hurry up and read this April 10th story from the Washington Post before it disappears down the memory hole. You can go to my website and find that as well, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. The article contains this gem. Although Zarqawi and other foreign insurgents in Iraq have conducted deadly bombing attacks, they remain, quote, a very small part of the actual numbers. Colonel Derek Harvey, who served as a military intelligence officer in Iraq and then was one of the top officers handling Iraqi intelligence on the told an army meeting. In a transcript of the meeting, Harvey said, quote, our own focus on Zarqawi has enlarged his caricature, if you will, made him more important than he really is in some ways. The long-term threat is not Zarqawi or religious extremists, but these former regime types and their friends, said Harvey. This doesn't mean that al-Zarqawi wasn't lower than pond scum, but he appeared to be an important part of our strategy alive because he met the stereotype. He was an al-Qaeda operative, he was a foreigner, and it gave the appearance as though the resistance in Iraq was made up of people like him. See, we're getting email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. This is from Jack in Dryden, Michigan. Zarqawi looked pretty darn good, though, dead, given the fact that the Pentagon's video footage showed two 500-pound bombs obliterating his ramshackle farmhouse. If the 747 could have been vaporized without virtually a trace after hitting the Pentagon, how the heck was al-Zarqawi killed and intact with only a bruise on his face? Was his body brought to the farmhouse after the bombing? Seems strange to me. It's not like he was in a concrete bunker and was killed by concussion. Now, what's interesting about that is that we have a government that no one trusts. Well, I wouldn't say no one. Jack does it. I don't. It's not like they immediately make a statement and then we accept it as fact. Too many people did that to begin with. Around 9/11, around Iraq, around 100 other instances that we've been lied to. So now, if they say al-Zarqawi was killed in this bunker, we're immediately going, well, all right, let's see if we can find out the real truth, right? All right. This leads us to this whole slaughterhouse, this huge mountain of corpses that is Iraq. 20,000 American casualties, probably 200,000 Iraqi casualties, all based on Bush's lies. And as I always say, if you want to be kind, mistaken intelligence. I guess that's what the right wingers say. They made it the intelligence was in error. So there's a couple hundred thousand people dead and wounded on a mistake. But we're trying to bring them democracy, aren't we? Now this poll that was taken by the Associated Press, this article about it, says, support the troops oppose the war. The latest Associated Press Ipsos poll found that many Americans perceive the atrocities against Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops as isolated incidents while saying the U.S.-led invasion was a mistake, a disconnect that sets this conflict apart from Vietnam. The military is investigating reports that a small number of Marines murdered 24 Iraqi civilians, and it begins to list a large number of, an uncomfortable number, I don't know what a large number is, an uncomfortable number of other incidences when the United States troops were accused in Iraq of killing civilians without any real reason. All right. Regardless of whether the allegations turn out to be true, 63% of those surveyed said they thought the killings of civilians were isolated incidences. Well, the Prime Minister, our buddy, the U.S. buddy, said that killings of Iraqi civilians is a regular occurrence by U.S. troops. So he seems to think differently than that. What does it mean, isolated? Certainly, the attacks on Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops is not policy. No one's saying, go out there and kill as many civilians as you can. That way, we're going to win the war. What the United States ostensibly is trying to do, it's got a lot more going on, but is to defeat the insurgency. Then we can have the dominance that the United States wants over oil and put this half billion dollar embassy, the largest in the world, something you can see from space. This is the embassy they're building right now in Baghdad. So, but let's look at what policy turns out to be, because we're fighting an irregular warfare. And you can go back to when United States troops landed in Vladivostok and Archangel in 1919. Young Polish guys from Detroit, immigrants, were sent in the Polar Bear Division, Polar Bear Brigade or whatever. They intervened in the newborn Soviet Union back when after the Soviet Revolution occurred. And they wrote home the same thing. You can't tell who is our enemy and who is our friend. They smile at you during the day, and then they shoot at you during the night. This is 1919. Go to My Lai in Vietnam, where Lieutenant Calley and his men killed 500 Vietnamese women and children and elderly people. Or you can go to Korea, where there was an incident at, let me see, what was the name of that? Nogunri, where American soldiers massacred up to 400 civilians. That's what happens. That's what happens in war, and particularly when the enemy is people of color. The United States did not do this to Germans. The United States we didn't come across many Japanese civilians, for instance. They just A-bombed all of them. But the United States wars, since World War II, has killed millions of civilians that are people of color. Millions. A million civilians were killed in this war we intervened in, essentially a civil war in Korea that we had no business going into. Vietnam, based totally, thoroughly, 100% on a pack of lies. 3 million civilians of color. And now we're starting to stack them up in Iraq as well. Now, does that mean that our troops are these awful, horrible, murderous, Nazi-like men and women? Men back then? It means that they are used in a manner where you can almost expect that. That the policymakers, whether whoever sent them over there 80, 90 years ago, the Johnsons and the Nixons in the 60s, the Bush 1 and now Bush 2, sending people off in a war that they should never be involved in, that's ultimately who bears responsibility for all this. They created the context where al-Zarqawi could come in pardon me, and do what he did. They created the context where Marines will go into a village and so enrage the death of their comrades that they'll kill women and children in the same thing. Now, let's see. They say this is isolated incident. This is an isolated incident. In an article called U.S. Says Zarqawi Survived Briefly After Airstrike, you probably saw that. Pardon me. Sounds like the winter, doesn't it? Here. In a town near the scene of Zarqawi's death, Galibia, a local Iraqi interviewed by telephone said American commandos dressed in black had raided the hamlet around 4 a.m. You saw this, they were going into all these other places and trying to get Zarqawi's operatives. The Iraqi, a farmer named Mustafa Muhammad, said a group of local Iraqis standing guard to protect their predominantly Sunni village from Shiite death squads fired their guns into the air. That's right, our allies, the Shiites, have death squads. Mr. Muhammad said they thought the Americans were a death squad because they were dressed in black. The American commandos threw a hand grenade in response, he said, killing five villagers. The people were saying that Americans were looking for Zarqawi loyalists. Mr. Muhammad said a group of American soldiers wearing regular army uniforms came to Galibia later in the day to apologize. They promised to provide compensation for the dead Iraqis. So is this an isolated incident? No. This is legitimate rules of engagement. Here's another one. This is from Marine Says Rules Were Followed. Sergeant describes hunt for insurgents in Haditha. AK-47 shots rang out from residents on the south side of the road, and the Marines ducked. A corporal with the unit said he saw the shots coming from a specific house, and after a discussion with the platoon leader, they decided to clear the house. There's a threat, and they wanted to eliminate the threat, was the quote. A four-man team of Marines kicked in the door and found a series of empty rooms, noticing quickly there was one room with a closed door and people rustling behind it. They then kicked in the door, tossed a fragmentation grenade into the room, and one Marine fired a series of clearing rounds through the dust and smoke, killing several people. The Marines who fired the rounds had experience clearing numerous houses on a deployment in Fallujah where Marines had aggressive rules of engagement. Although it was almost immediately apparent to the Marines that the people dead in the room were men, women, and children, most likely civilians, they also noticed a nearby door ajar and believed that insurgents had slipped through to a house nearby. The Marines stealthily moved to the second house, kicking in the door, killing one man inside, and then using a frag grenade and more gunfire to clear another room full of people, he said. So what's this? Is this an isolated incident? Is this something we really don't want to mention? Or is this exactly what you and I would be doing if we were attached to these units, if we were sent into a situation like this by these men in Washington who did everything that they could and successfully avoided service during the war in Vietnam? Whatever you call it, isolated, legitimate rules of engagement, there is this mountain of corpses laid at the feet of George W. Bush, of Dick Cheney, of Donald Rumsfeld, and the rest of them. How bad is it? Well, here's another article. So you got to link all this stuff together. I mean, I get paid to do this. Most of you don't have the stomach for it, or, you know, I don't blame you. Sometimes I wonder why I do. My wife says, I started to tell you, I don't want to hear this. I can't deal with this in the morning. She says, I don't know how you can. Compensation payments rising, especially by Marines. Almost half of the more than $19 million in compensation. Remember, any time funds are mentioned and that are expended, you and I are footing the bill. Rather than our tax money coming back to help our communities see where they're going. So almost $20 million in compensation that the American military allocated last year to compensate for killing or injuring Iraqis and damaging properties came from Marine-led units in Anbar province. The $10 million in condolence payments by the Marines reflects the persistent fighting against insurgents in violent Anbar, but it also provides a reminder of the heavy toll that the conflict has taken on civilians, mostly from insurgents, but also from American units. And so, for instance, they paid $38,000 to relatives of 15 Iraqis killed by Marines at Haditha in November. Those are the ones that are, the claim is that they were massacred. The total does include millions paid to the residents of Fallujah after the Marines cleared the city in block-by-block fighting, as well as hundreds of smaller payments from $50 to $50,000. So that would be if the Chinese were in here and they figured, well, you people are suffering under George W. Bush, so we're going to liberate your country and we're going to install the kind of country that we, the Chinese, feel that you should have. So in the meantime, we're all fighting, right? We've all got guns, just like the Iraqis do. So we're fighting as best we can against the Chinese invaders, and most people aren't. Most people are just kind of hiding, but the particularly young people are fighting back, and then they come running into your house, and you're just trying to stay safe, and they throw a fragmentation grenade because they're afraid that one of us is in there getting ready to shoot them, and then they come with $50, say, sorry about that. Well, what do you think? I think that we ought to get out of Iraq immediately before another drop of blood is shed on either side.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud. It's local. And no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. I just wanted to remind you, many of you use the wonderful website, WhiteRoseSociety.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org. They archive this broadcast and also many others as well of the same political point of view. They're doing a fundraiser. They need you. If you utilize their site, please consider making a contribution. Also, I'll just give a shout out right now to radiopower.org that also streams this and then repeats this broadcast twice on Monday, radiopower.org. So check them both out, whiterosesociety.org, radiopower.org as well. All right, so I got to press the buttons here and get Nick. Nick's calling from North Branch. Nick, hey, it's Peter Werby on WRIF, and you're on the air with me.
I'm on the air right now?
Right now, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that means you start talking then.
Oh, hello, Peter?
Hey, Nick. Hi, you're on the air. Turn your radio completely off. Going great.
Gotcha, man. All right, I'll just listen to all right, what's up? I was just kind of, I've been listening the last 20 minutes, you know, kind of hearing about the whole Zarqawi supposed killing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of elaborate on some of the things that were said, you know, I kind of find it hard to believe, obviously, that 2 500-pound bombs could kill the guy, but like you said, you know, he's... You know, you see the pictures, and like you said, it just kind of looks like he may have gotten, like, a bar fight or something, you know. I'm totally agreeing with that. I think, like you said, it's more of a propaganda thing than what it is anything. But I guess the one thing, too, as you went on, a lot of stuff I was going to say you kind of mentioned, but I guess the one thing that does kind of get me, though, is I'm not much of one to watch the mainstream news as it is, but only time I really do is I'm at work on lunch or something because, well, I don't really care about that. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
What I was saying is it's kind of funny how when 9/11 first happened, of course, you know, there's Bin Laden over the place, you know, and they were – I remember the one thing that was on the news forever, like the one thing they always said was, well, if we kill Bin Laden and we get him, you know, is it actually going to end terrorism or is it going to, you know, is it going to make it worse? You know, of course, you had the two sides saying, well – you know, it could either it's going to take away the leader and it's going to help the war, or it's just going to spur, you know, more, I guess, anger and rage throughout the Taliban or the terrorist networks, you know.
Well, things are really going down the drain in Afghanistan. The Taliban have regrouped. They're fighting more and more successfully, sometimes even in frontal warfare. In other words, confronting NATO troops and U.S. troops as brigades. And we see it's metastasized because of what Muslim people, and 99.9% of Muslim people do not do anything, just it's true about everything with everybody. But we start to have these groups that have nothing to do directly with Al-Qaeda, like the subway bombers in London, or now the subway and the buses in London, and now this arrest, if this turns out to be accurate, in Canada. And that's the real fear, because these images and the kind of stories that I was repeating earlier that most Americans don't like to hear, in fact, often get angry if you cite these things. If you start talking about some of these massacres that have occurred, and famous ones at My Lai and the other one in Korea, people, it's like, why are you mentioning that? It's just kind of rude, because we always want to see our troops as always acting heroic. It's always this John Wayne imagery. But when men are put into particular situations, you can expect almost for sure that certain type of behavior is going to occur. And we see that going on here. All right, Nick, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Chris. Chris is in Detroit. Chris, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRIF.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Am I on there?
You're on the air, Chris.
Oh, okay. Right on. I'm a first-time caller. I really like what you're doing with the show.
Well, thank you.
The thing that kills me is the way that Bush's administration used the terrorist attacks on 9/11 in manipulating the mass population through media into thinking that that had something to do with Iraq.
Right.
And they were, you know, the way they went about doing it, they brought everybody into this without educating them. I mean, I think people as a whole are very ignorant, especially if they're following this mob. So
Well, wait a minute, Chris. The only good news now is the majority of people don't think that. But just every time you hear these guys speaking, and I don't care whether it's, we're saddled with these right-wing Republicans, but I would say this would apply to the Democrats as well. Just cue that in your mind, that old classic rock song, you know, Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's important, that the next time around, because these guys are going to be trying to pull the same thing on us, believe it, they're going to try to pull something before the November elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that kills me is just, you know, like Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda network would have been a threat to Saddam Hussein's power and his tyrannistic style of government.
Sure. They hated each other.
He never would have harbored him or their group, you know what I mean? And here they're using it there. And how many times did our government change our reasons for being in Iraq? I mean, first they were looking for weapons of mass destruction. Then it was, removing Saddam Hussein from power. Then it was liberating the Iraqi people. And now it's like spreading democracy.
Yeah. Well, it's an odd way to go about spreading democracy. All right, Chris, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF is our phone call. Our phone number, isn't it? Here's Greg in Southgate. Greg, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you today?
Doing good.
I just wanted to know if I actually didn't pick up or start listening to you until about 11, so I don't know if you mentioned this, but I don't have cable television, so I don't get bombarded with all the crap, most of the crap everybody else does. But Channel 9, the CDC, mm-hmm. is reporting that some people on the ground, Iraqis, had witnessed some Marines pulling up and dragging a body out of the...
Really?
Did you hear anything about this? Or have you mentioned anything about this?
Well, I didn't. I actually had one piece, and it said it couldn't be corroborated, so I didn't bring it. But there was a report on an NBC station that there was a witness that said that he had seen Marines beating a man that looked like Zarqawi.
Really?
Well, really, it said that. I don't know if really it happened.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's surprising. I something is totally, you know, I don't know.
Well,
I had to just chime in about that.
Well, I'm glad you did, Greg. But you know what I said earlier, and what you may have missed, I think that it's interesting that great numbers of Americans, I don't know whether it's 5% of us or 50% or 85% of us, do not necessarily believe what the United States government tells us. We don't. Right. We think, wow, wait a minute, this sounds a little fishy. Let me say one other thing, too, about cable TV. I don't have cable TV either, and people talk to me sometimes about the fact that I rarely watch television.
Right.
I'll watch it if Pistons are playing or something like that. But if I thought that television or cable television was important to news gathering and information, I would be watching it and be subscribing to it like in a second. But I don't think you need it whatsoever.
No, they're just talking heads. They really are.
Yeah, and it's the wrong talking heads. It's not like you ever get a full spectrum of what's happening. I mean, here now, you see the 2/3 of the American people think that it was a mistake going into Iraq. Bush's popularity is down into the mid to low 30s. And you would think that they would have somebody on that represented the critics that properly framed what now most people believe about Bush and his war and the economy and all of that. But no, you never get it. All right, Greg, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I mean, it's infuriating. So you have like right winger, and then you have somebody who's kind of a centrist posing as like a left winger for balance, and you have these freak shows with these right wing screamers that then get somebody on on their program and they're telling them, shut up. I said shut up. I can't handle it. All right, here's Eric in New Boston. Eric, hey, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
He was kind of a centrist.
Hey, turn it off, Eric. Hi.
Hello,
why is everybody doing this tonight? Eric? Eric.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Eric, turn your radio off completely.
Turn my radio off completely.
Yeah, turn it off completely. Jay Hudson is our producer, and I hope Jay Hudson is telling him that. I'm sure he is. So listen to him. He's the boss. I just work here. Eric?
Yeah, I'm here, brother.
Go ahead. You're on.
What's happening?
Wait, what am I hearing?
I turned off the radio. Sorry, I was outside working in the garage.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to talk to you about just how things are getting so crazy. And I absolutely, you know, it's just how crazy things have gotten. And I wanted to...
Anything particular in your life or just that feeling? A lot of us have things happening to us. Other people just get this feeling that we're just sort of waiting for another shoe to drop.
Yet, it's so crazy because I've been on hold for so long. I was wanted to talk to you about what you were talking about earlier, just how crazy things have gotten.
Things are pretty crazy. Yeah. Well, they are. They're pretty crazy. All right, Eric, thank you. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Don't feel the reaper. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to the program. This is our second hour. At 1 a.m., we'll be doing some interviews, 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 313-298-WRIF. And you can email us at us, yes, me and Jay. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. I forgot to say ITMFA. If you don't know what that means by now, you can either go to ITMFA.com, ITMFA.com. Caution, rude language there. If you're offended easily, do not go to ITMFA.com, or you go to my website, PeterWerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. All right, we're talking about what in the hell happened at that bomb site, that house where Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was, where 1,000 pounds of TNT exploded, and they brought him out for a photo op, where within a couple of hours we have this large framed, matted, developed, I'm going backwards, and photographed shot of this body with a guy that looks like he was maybe in a bar fight or something like that. Everything else, everyone else, is absolutely obliterated. Maybe you saw that framed picture of Zarqawi. Maybe they're going to, like, put it up on eBay and use it to reduce the national debt that Bush has gotten us into. I mean, this war, these wars are just costing us tens of millions of dollars a day. I don't know if anybody has a figure on it, but it's enormous. Now, I just wanted to throw one other thing into the hopper you may want to comment on. How many of you out there are considering burning an American flag? Most of us now, the majority of us, think that George W. Bush is not doing a good job in the presidency. Numerous ones of us think he's the most vile and stupid president that has ever hit the United States of America. Like the Dixie Chicks say, well, they're ashamed he was born in Texas. Many of us are ashamed he was born in the United States, that he's doing great harm to our Constitution, to our environment, to the whole of what most of us consider what the United States is all about. So how many of you have said, well, the way I got to deal with this, I'm going to go out and burn a flag? Nobody. That's what I thought. And how many of you, well, I don't want to be silly. You know what's going on here. The United States Senate fortunately lost or the idea that we would get a constitutional amendment to outlaw gay marriage. In the foundation document of the United States Constitution, which is about administering the government and also safeguarding our rights, is not a something for social policy like that. And it, of course, was an election year ploy. But in the meantime, it further demonized, or attempted to demonize, the gay men and women who are our friends and our relatives and our community members. Just at a time, for instance, I mean, this is how vile and opportunistic these Republicans are. Just at a point where people are kind of taking a deep breath and the number of people opposing gay marriage is dropping considerably, here come these election year opportunists to ramp up the idea that these are people that do not have the right to say, I love you, I want to be committed to you as a partner, and this will be recognized by the political state and will have any number of advantages accrue to them, including giving them finally the kind of equal status in people's minds and in law that they richly deserve. Okay? What was it? Was it? Yeah, it was here. I've been doing some national shows as well. But yeah, someone, remember last week, told our phone screener that I was a queer lover. I am a queer lover. I'm also an N lover. Whatever you hate, I love. All right? Once we get beyond these categories, then we don't talk about queers or gays or anything like that. We talk about individual human beings, and we don't care about their skin color or their sexual preference or their gender or anything like that. It's just the very awful people of the world that keep up that intolerance and those hatreds going so that it's all kind of, you know, tucked into these, their neat little categories, right? And if you're outside of one, well. All right, so the United States Senate voted it down, it being the constitutional amendment that Bush wanted to wanted to see in the Constitution. I mean, what is Dick Cheney? Dick Cheney has a gay daughter. What the hell does his daughter think about that? I mean, but people said that Cheney was opposed to the constitutional amendment. Maybe for, as you know, if you're a conservative, you wouldn't want that in to begin with. And if having a gay daughter, I mean, why didn't this guy have little guts and stand up and say, you know, this is reprehensible. This constitutional amendment they're proposing is in its final throes. Oh, yeah, he said that about the insurgency a year ago in Iraq, didn't he? Anyway, so it was 49-48, 49-4, 48 against, and everyone's cheering. So almost half the United States Senate says that the love that certain people have for one another can be abolished in the foundation document. This would be like saying that all you could have, I mean, how many nations have this? I don't know how many. Not too many, fortunately, but have restrictions. I mean, why not say only white Christian Gentiles can marry? Something like that we've seen before, right? And the United States had laws against interracial marriage up until 1967. You couldn't marry between the races. 1967, it took a Supreme Court decision. Activist judges is what these vile Republicans call the court system that stands up for the principles of the Constitution. All right, so now they're moving on. Another wedge issue. The wedge issue is they want you to call me. When you hear this, they go, you queer lover. Here, you, and, you know, you flag burner and stuff like that. What about the economy? I don't care about that. What about abortion? What about the war in Iraq? I don't care about that. They're killing little babies. You know? And so they put all this into play. So we won't keep our eyes on the prize. We won't keep our eye on what's the most important issues of the day. So the next thing is a ban on flag burning into the Constitution that is going to allow states to pass laws against flag desecration. This gives you another idea of the conservative mentality and how little respect they have for the Constitution. The conservative, I can't remember when it was the late 90s or something like that, maybe even the early 90s, but the Supreme Court held that as odious as the act was, that of flag burning, to many Americans, maybe most Americans, maybe almost all Americans, it was still protected political speech, and it is only done as a protest. Now, the New York Times editorial that I'm looking at said there hasn't been a single instance of anti-American flag burning in the last 30 years, that they're talking about either other countries or Vietnam-era vintage or other countries. I saw somebody burn a flag 15 years ago. It was a little communist group that it was sort of their hobby, that they wanted to look militant. And, of course, it just pissed everybody off big time and ruined the event that people were trying to sponsor. So, but it rarely ever happens. It rarely ever occurs. Because even if people see the kind of fake patriotism that Bush and his crew try to wrap themselves in, they know as a matter of political tactics that if you want to lose any popular support or interest or sympathy, the last thing in the world you'd want to do it. So they're going to put this forth, an anti-flag burning amendment. And even the Democrats are signing on because they don't want to appear unpatriotic. So you got Hillary is one of the co-sponsors of it. The Democratic Minority Leader, Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, is doing. I mean, this is absolutely reprehensible. And I'll tell you what. So if you're kind of wondering where am I eventually going with this, how many of you think that you'd like to see flags being burned? No, nobody. Don't see any hands up. Up way in the back there, one hand. Well, that one hand up there is going to get her wish, because if the United States Congress passes this constitutional amendment, there will go from being no problem to a major problem. If anti-flag burning statutes are reinstated, that you will see flags going up in flames all across the United States as a way of saying F you. You can't tell me what to do with my plastic flag made in China. It's mine. Yeah. So it's going to be it will accomplish exact well, what it's trying to accomplish is this, you know, BS patriotism that these characters are always trying to shove down our throats. All right, your opinions on that, anything else as well. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dave in Clinton Township. Dave, hold on one second. I wanted to say one thing. You're wondering why everyone's listening to the radio and getting caught off guard. There's something wrong with our phone system. So people are listening to the radio to follow what's going on, but we're on like a 7 or 8 second delay. So I don't know how you people are on hold or are going to figure this out. Hopefully Dave has got it figured out. Dave, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on WRIF. Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I got my phone knocked. Actually, I was calling in just to tell you I had a great subject you got going there. I'm not usually up at this time of night. I get up at 3 in the morning. So, but when I do, I tune you in. And being on hold there, you got so much energy in me going right now. It's like, don't get me started on George Bush, please, because, I mean, the nice word part of the thing is he's a moron, I think. And I think people agree, but I agree with you. I think it's time for some people over there to come back home. I agree, you know, I'm happy that they're over fighting for us and everything and whatnot, but it's a waste of time over there. Now they should come back, because those people over there do not appreciate what we're doing over there for them anyways, and if I was a people over there, I wouldn't want them running my country anyways. It's their country. Let them do what they want. Now, we got what's-his-name out of power, and I really don't think he was that big of an input. You know, if his old man would have gotten him out years ago, you know, this would have never happened. But where's the real culprit being kept? Bin Laden.
Yeah,
know?
I mean, well, actually, we call him, you know, Bin Forgotten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, where's all this? I mean, I don't know if you've seen the movie Fahrenheit 9/11. I don't know how much true that is true or not. It's a very good movie, and that's true that his family's friends with Bin Laden's family. This kind of makes you think what's going on. You know, it's like a big smoke screen. But it's time to capture the real culprit, get him out of the way. You know, it's nice they got Zarqawi.
Well, that's right. They got rid of Saddam. Osama bin Forgotten, and they got Zarqawi. So hey, bring the troops home now. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Scott in Royal Oak. Scott, hi. You're on the air.
Peter, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks.
I'd like to address two things, if possible.
Sure.
First, you know, the flag and gay issue. I think this is Karl Rove 101, that you bring up irrelevant, kind of unimportant issues. Not to say that gay marriage is unimportant, but doesn't really affect Americans hardly at all. So you bring up these irrelevant, unimportant issues, and you pull a certain type of voter out of the woodwork. These certain types of voters of a certain stripe and character tend to vote conservative Republican. But
sure.
They did in Ohio in the 2004 election. In fact, if those issues hadn't been brought up in Ohio, Kerry might have won the election.
Well, wait a minute here. I got to say right off the bat, you got to go look on my website and look at this Robert F. Kennedy Jr. article, and where he talks about how the election was effectively stolen in Ohio. So, I mean, there were so many people, they had all the, even beyond the electronic voting machines, that the Republicans made sure in the Democratic district they denied perhaps voting to a few hundred thousand people that easily turned the election to Bush. So this is two stolen ones in a row. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
It doesn't surprise me, and that kind of is a good segue to ask you. And it's been brought up before, and if you've addressed it, just stop me and I'll hang up. But it has to do with the casualty count. My rack, and I've heard and I've read in certain websites, heard from friends that the actual casualty rate that we're being fed are for soldiers who actually die within the geographic scope of Iraq itself.
Yeah.
In other words, if you're medevaced out, which is most people who get wounded, to a hospital in Berlin or in the United States or an aircraft carrier, and you die there, that doesn't count for the death toll that we're being fed. And that had those numbers been counted, that it would be staggering, perhaps 10,000, 15,000.
Well, you know, Scott, I've heard that a lot. And on my website, where, in fact, bloom, I'm just looking at it right now, 2,486 as of June 10th. That's yesterday. And I have in parentheses, this figure has to be seen as the minimum U.S.-Iraq casualties. It never includes includes those who die from wounds later. The total casualty count of dead and wounded is more like 50,000. That's what I have on my own website. Wait a minute, let's check. This is from USA Today, and because I've been saying like 20,000, and this is quite an old article. It's from October 2005. They say 1 in 4 Iraq vets ailing on return. USA Today. More than 250, nearly 20,000 reported nightmares or unwanted war recollections. Well, I guess they're including them as well. Not that we should scoff at that. I mean, how would you like to be, I don't know if you heard the show earlier when I was describing these Marine clearing operations where you burst into somebody's home because you're sent there to get rid of the insurgents, you throw in a fragmentation grenade, you shoot into the room, you go in there, and there's dead women, kids, and some men, and what does that do to your psyche? When is that going to leave your mind? I don't think for quite a few years, if ever.
If ever, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Scott, thanks for having joined us. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here I don't get complete information, but someone calling from Chelsea, is it?
Yeah. Hi, Peter.
Hi, who's this?
This is Dan in Chelsea.
Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
First thing I want to say is next time I'm at a 4th of July picnic and I see somebody with one of those paper plates with the American flag and they get a little barbecue sauce on them, I'm going to call the cops.
You have to. What about all those women with the American flag on their bikini, on their butts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to call them the cops, Peter.
We got it. We got it.
Anyway, but what I want to talk about is this Ann Coltman. You know, she said something far, far more offensive than anything the Dixie Chicks ever said or anything like that. But the same people who would be out there boycotting the Dixie Chicks will race out and buy Ann Coulter's book.
I have some trepidation about even letting you give her name, because here's a woman who has made a career of saying outrageous things. She's advocates violence against the opponents of Bush and made these disparaging remarks about the 9/11 widows. And what she knows is, like, you may have just sent her book sales up by 20 in Detroit. Do you realize that?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Because here's what we always say. Me and P.T. Barnum, that 19th century showman, any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right. So she makes the most outrageous claims and statements, and people have debunked all of her sources and said she's the most awful person in the world and everything under the sun. Personal attacks on her, and she gets ink in every paper. She gets on television shows. All of her right-wing buddies invite her, and she's the mistress of PR.
And not only that, they got people like Sean Hannity calling her a great American. But also, Peter, what I wanted to mention, I would hope people in Detroit, even if they're not fans, will vote for the Dixie Chicks, because these women really have paid a price. And they down in the South and in redneck land, their tours are not selling as well as they probably would have, and it's all because they dared to say something bad about the Fuhrer, George W. Bush.
You know, that's interesting though, because after they made that statement, when was I actually, like 2003? That's right, 2003. They had the highest grossing tour of all, and interestingly, while they were performing their best-selling album at the time, they were showing videos in back of them while they were singing of, like, civil rights demonstrations, and I always forget her name. What's her first name? Maines.
Natalie
Maines. She had on her shorts while she was singing, it said F-U-T-K. I mean, that's just the initials, you know, but it meant F-U Toby Keith. And it also is thought that all of the calls the country stations got saying don't play the Dixie Chicks came from non-country music listeners that were encouraged by, like, one of the right-wing talk show hosts that you mentioned, whose names I never mentioned, and the Oxycontin freak as well. He's probably high when he told him. Actually, the other woman, what I was calling her on this national show I was doing, what did I say? TDP, that dreadful person. She did say a funny thing about the addict. She said, the left has finally found a dope addict they don't like.
So, but you got that right.
Yeah, yeah. But the Dixie Chicks, they had the number one best-selling album last week. They had the number one best-selling single. Yet for some reason, cities like St. Louis and Houston, but Indianapolis, Oklahoma City, Memphis, aren't doing that well.
And, you know, they have a double sellout in Toronto. Isn't that interesting? That two nights in a row, like about 16,000. And then, like, down in Fargo, North Dakota, they said they sold about 500 tickets.
Is that a lot or a little for there?
A little.
Oh, okay.
But it's sort of like it goes right along the red state, blue state map is how they're doing as far as their concert tour goes.
You know, it shows what a pack of fascists they are. Because think about this. If someone called up here, and I haven't done any DJ work on WRIF in a few years, and said, play Wang Dang Doodle or Fred Bear by Ted Nugent, I'd say sure. Even though that he's a right-wing idiot of the first magnitude, and you know what I'm saying, I would say, well, all right, you know, the guy's I don't agree with him in the slightest, and he doesn't agree with me in the slightest, but I'll play his music because he's a damn good guitarist.
It reminds me of the McCarthyism of the 50s, what they're trying to do to these women.
Yeah, but think about this: they do not toe the line. And their history. Well, the Dixie Chicks say that they are no longer part of the country community, that they consider themselves part of the rock community, because overwhelmingly people in the rock community are liberal and left. Yet there's plenty of room for the Nugents and a couple others that are right wing to be in, with us, because what we're interested in is their music, not their politics, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate you calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Isn't that true? I mean, aren't those folks just the height of intolerance? Imagine that. They're not going to play somebody's music singing about love because they said they were ashamed George W. Bush was from Texas. Well, what would you think of me if I said, I'm not going to play Cat Scratch Fever because Ted Nugent is a far right winger, huh? A gun nut. I mean, wouldn't you think little of me? Less of me? I would expect you would. That's what people usually say to me. What do you think about Ted Nugent? I say, plays good guitar. All right, here's Steve in Farmington. Steve, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Oh, okay, I'm going to turn it down.
Okay, yeah, we're having some problems with that, so.
What? What's that?
With you can't hear the show on hold.
Well, I can because I have music up.
Okay, well, go ahead.
All right?
Yeah, Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay.
Steve?
Yeah.
You're on the air. Hi.
Okay, hi. Peter Orr?
Yeah, me.
Hey, I love the show.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, no one's talked about the global impact of the Bush administration.
Like what, particularly?
Well, South America, for one thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of scaring me. We're seeing more and more of these, Bush pushes Democratic. We got a problem here, don't you think?
In South America?
Yes.
Well, he's kind of getting his butt beat down there. What with Chavez?
Yeah,
and
Chavez
Venezuela.
And some certain leaders are
trying
to take over. I know this is kind of a...
I hate it when they try to take over their own country, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
a problem.
That's my concern.
Well, there's lots of concerns. Thank you for sharing yours. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Jeff in Harrison Township, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff.
Good.
Jeff.
How you
doing? Good.
Yeah.
I'm doing great. Go ahead. You're on the air. Shut your radio off and talk to us out here on WRIF land.
All right.
Okay. Jeff.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jeff!
I'm calling to talk about, because I was listening on the radio, how you guys were talking about the people in Iraq getting killed and the military is paying money to them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, my best friend was that guy that got shot on Telford Air Base when he ran his geo tracker through there.
Oh, yeah. What was up with that?
Well,
we should tell people that somebody kind of, he broke through the security and was driving around and they finally shot him?
Yep.
Wow. Did they kill him?
Yeah, they killed him.
Man.
They shot him in the back with M16 and 9mm.
Boy.
And it was never released to the public, but when the paramedic on call that night ended up going to Selfridge, they found him outside of his tracker laying face down on the ground, shot in the back.
Uh-huh.
And they're talking about the rules of engagement. I heard you guys talking about that on the radio.
Right.
And I looked some stuff up on the internet about the rules of engagement, and it said that in a case like that, to use lethal force has to come from a higher authority. And they never released to the public, who gave the order to shoot, open fire, or whatever.
Wow. How old was your friend?
He was 35.
What, any idea what possessed him to do that?
Well, he had mental illness. He suffered from a closed head injury from when he was 14 years old.
Wow.
He got into an accident. And he, I guess he tried to get himself a couple times before it happened. Because he wanted to look at some museum or something, and they wouldn't let him on for some reason, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why he did what he did, but he just did it.
Well, these are dangerous times to cross some boundaries and barriers, and he certainly ran afoul. It's just so unfortunate that we have so many people that are so distraught that they act out in a manner like that. It's a sad story. All right, Jeff, thank you. Thanks for telling us about it. Here, James is listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and he writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I went to Pride Fest in Milwaukee yesterday. Pride Fest is a gay event. There was one week, 2 weeks ago in Ferndale, Michigan here, suburb of Detroit. I went to Pride Fest in Milwaukee yesterday to see a friend's band perform. Now, look, I went out today and bought a home decorating magazine. You see the evil influence? Yeah, right. Wisconsin voters will soon face a referendum to ban gay marriage via an amendment to the state constitution, just like in Michigan. Well, I hope that it does better than it did here. Seeing as the Constitution enumerates the rights, privileges, and responsibility of the state citizens, it would be a tragic mistake to change the very nature of the Constitution by turning it into an instrument of discrimination. In Wisconsin, please vote no. In Washington, tell Bush and friends to pack up their amendment and dispose of it in an environmentally friendly manner. Indeed. All right, another call coming at us, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby here with you. It is Joe from Garden City. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Right here, how you doing?
Good, you're on the air right now.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I listen to your show every Sunday night. How you doing?
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Hey, I just had a couple comments, and I think that I joined probably the vast majority of people who fall in the middle somewhere between, liberal and conservative. I listen to your show, and I listen to a lot of conservative shows as well. My concern is that I've got a favorite comedian, George Carlin, who I think you probably like as well.
Sure, love him.
He made a comment, and I don't know what you think of this, but that the country has been bought and paid for, and every 4 years we just shuffle around whatever's at the top. So basically it boils down to the haves and have-nots.
I think it's changed some. It used to be Tweedledum and Tweedledee and Tweedledum. in other words, that it was a one-party state, which kind of like South American countries that just shuffled between two elite parties. It's changed significantly, though, and at least in my estimation, and led me for the first time in my life to vote for a Democratic Party candidate for president. How forgettable, John Kerry. And not that I thought much of him, and nor did I think much of his campaign. I mean, sure, it was stolen by just as the 2000 election was, with the majority of votes going to Democrats, but altered in different ways in each time. But had either of those candidates taken forthright stands on issues that the difference in the vote would have been so great that the Republicans wouldn't have been able to practice their tricks and chicanery and what have you.
But don't you think that it could have gone either way? I mean, you hear this stuff, basically what it boils down to, you know, when election time rolls around, it's basically just, you know, what kind of dirt they can dig up on the other party.
Sure.
So in the long run, it's like, who is there? Do we need a third party to get some honesty, you know, in our government?
Well, people that are dissatisfied with the state of things have been talking about third parties maybe for the last 100 to 150 years. I think, didn't the Republicans even begin as that? But they haven't had much success. Certainly the Green Party has a few local candidates that they've elected. The Labor Party, which is a traditionally, like they have in Europe, fielding candidates that and its apparatus is based on labor unions, and they're putting their first electoral effort together. And I don't know, it's depressing. I never put much stock in electoral politics. I did enough, of course, to vote for John Kerry, and I would think it would be extraordinarily important to gain at least a majority in one of the houses this November, so that whichever house Democrats hold sway in, that they can begin an investigation process of all of these crimes that have been committed by Bush, to the extent that my colleague Mike Malloy refers to them as the Bush crime family, the BCF. But a third party, it's just never really worked real well in the United States.
I don't disagree with you about Bush, but I think that had there been a Democratic leader at the time, I think we could probably, we'd be, you know, I'd be calling a different talk show talking about, you know, what the Democratic Party had done.
Well, actually, every once in a while someone calls in and says, well, your boy Clinton, and I go, whoa, wait a minute here. All I did was say how poorly they performed during their 8 years in office. Now, well, there's a couple of things. First off, if Al Gore, who won the 2000 presidency, but was cheated out of it, and they got the majority, got more votes than Bush. Very odd system. The man that comes in second, that the least amount of people want, winds up to be the winner. But, you know, so it goes. That there would have not been, there could possibly have not been a 9/11 attack, because hopefully that President Gore wouldn't have been at his ranch and had this his national security advisor show him a memo saying that bin Laden is getting ready to strike in the United States, and done absolutely nothing. But even if he had, well, I'm sure then the Republicans would have made a move to impeach him. I don't even know that if I would have opposed that, just like I can't imagine how Bush's popularity rose after 9/11 rather than people think, wait a minute, this guy presided over the worst intelligence failure in American history and allowed the most domestic casualties ever under his reign, after he had been warned time and time again by different people within the national security apparatus. President Gore would not have invaded Iraq. President Gore would have not repealed one environmental executive order after another. President Gore would have not changed things like the arsenic, how much arsenic is allowed in the water, wouldn't have reversed mining safety directives, wouldn't, and fill in the blanks, wouldn't have cozied up to the oil companies so that now we're paying $3 a gallon, and on and on and on and on. So I think that is at least the difference. All right, I got to take a break. Thanks for calling us. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsor, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes
prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our final segment of our talk show. And then 1 a.m. Eastern Time, a couple of interviews for you. I think you'll find them interesting. Well, here is JB. JB, I'm going to give a shout out to him. He's listening in Lincoln City, Oregon, and he's not going to hear it probably till tomorrow or the next day because he says from last week, Peter, I'm listening to your great podcast from the beach on the Central Oregon coast. So if you've got iPod capacity, we're there. Just go to WRIF.com. And yeah. All right, so let's go right back to our phones. I keep forgetting. I just said I've been doing this national show, and this all gets done for me. I prefer to do it myself, but I remember I got to push some of my own buttons here. Jason's in Pontiac. Jason, hey, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Hey, I heard you talking about the Dixie Chicks earlier.
Yeah.
And that's really just young country that's really right wing because. I mean, people like Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and all of them.
Sure.
They're pretty liberal people,
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of progressive country, I know.
Yeah, and then also, what is it with conservatives? They always want to say things like, hey, you know, we understand that taxes are going up and insurance is going up, the cost of living is going up, and all these things are going up, but we want you to drop your wages. What's that? I don't understand that. And how come people are always, you know, agreeing with them? And
well, I don't know that all people agree with them. Certainly anybody who's a worker, a middle-class person, if they do, they don't understand their own class interests. The wealthy class of owners, they understand fully their class interests, and they always take care of it. They take care of it at their place of employment, and they take care of it in the state house and in Washington, D.C. Then what's really pathetic, as you're indicating, are these conservatives that are just like working class guys or something like that. I mean, these conservatives have been able to pose themselves in this macho manner. So you think that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are tough guys, which I don't understand this. These are guys that scammed out of the military through being middle class or even in Bush's case, wealthy, up till 2002, when the Democrats kind of lost everything in Washington, the entire Democratic leadership was all Vietnam era veterans, were all armed forces veterans, and none of the Republicans were, and yet they're still able to make these arguments. Well, look what they did to John Kerry. Here's this guy, an authentic hero in Vietnam, all these medals, and you've got them challenging his bona fides as a veteran. See, they're always making all this stuff about veterans and patriotism in the armed forces until they don't agree with you. And there was this guy in the senator in Georgia who had lost three of his limbs in the Vietnam War, and they crapped on him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
I just don't understand them. And you know what else? They always say, buy American, buy American, buy American. But yet, 2000, car sales were the highest. And they, you know, fired all them people. 2001, and it went down as they were giving away more jobs. Especially the car industry is like, you know what? We have lost the philosophy of Henry Ford's, you know, his philosophy was, I pay my employees so they can buy my products.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Jason. A friend of mine, it was so strange, just one friend drove up, and another guy just happened along, was walking in our neighborhood, and one friend started getting on my other friend's case about having, I don't even know what kind of car she had.
A Kia, probably?
No. It was an older car, and she had bought it used. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, man. General Motors is laying off all these people they've just, all these communities are going to be suffering tremendously from shutdowns.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Kia, and Kia is opening, a Korean firm, is opening up a $1 billion facility in our country on the Georgia-Alabama border and going to provide thousands of jobs. So
yeah, it's like, why do I want to buy a GM car to help these people, these, you know, CEOs with their lifestyles when they won't help me with my lifestyle by giving me a job?
There you go. That's it. All right, Jason, thank you very much. Remember when there was what was it? Maybe even long ago, it was the 70s. People say, real Americans buy Americans. And then people countered by saying, real Americans buy what they want. And, what happened to the competitiveness that's supposed to typify the capitalist system? So even though American cars are, at that time, 70s, putting out these piles of junk, and these Japanese cars are really terrific, you're supposed to buy the worst car that gets the worst mileage because, hey, they're Americans. And, yeah, you think, well, wait a minute, what about the jobs? Well, whose fault is that? It's the guys at the top that have made mistakes for decade after decade after decade, and you see the results of it now. Why is Kia able to build a brand-new billion-dollar facility? Why are Korean and Japanese, getting 43% of the American market? And why can't American firms duplicate that success? It sure isn't the man and the woman on the production line. It's the guys at the top. The buck stops there. Of course, the bucks stop there as well. They don't stay with the people that are really doing the hard work. All right, here's Chris in Dearborn Heights. Chris, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Peter, hey, you're dead on there with the foreign car versus the American car.
Yeah.
Competition builds the better car.
Yeah.
It's important that's our vote. Our money is our vote.
There you go.
But I also wanted to say, I wanted to ask you, with this, this is not a tea for you.
What?
Granholm versus DeVos. I'm really starting to believe that I'm a Democratic person with a Republican income, and I do believe the state's better off with a Republican in office.
Well, you're going to have then, if things go on as they are, a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. So it's going to be a one-party state. DeVos is a far right winger who is going to dismantle any protection for working people. And I mean, I don't know that Granholm is anything particularly to write home about, but here is DeVos that presided over this essentially this pyramid scheme of Amway. And has been involved in all sorts of deals to protect the wealth of the very, very rich. And, God, his ads on TV are masterful. Man, show him with the sleeves rolled up, and he's a businessman and what have you. But I mean, his politics are farther to the right than George W. Bush. And one of the things, think, you know, the people that are condemned by the conservatives, the right wingers, to the right, you know, dark or the hottest room in right wing hell, are the movie stars, the rock stars, people like that that are liberal. And the reason they are, they're saying, wait a minute, why aren't you voting your pocketbook? Why aren't you voting to get more and more and more money, even if it means the middle class and the working class get screwed? That's why they hate them so badly. So vote your conscience. Don't vote your pocketbook. You know, we've got enough.
Well, I agree. It's just this whole helmet law, it really bothered me she's going to veto it because I believe she's going to get more money out of tickets written for people without helmets.
Wait a minute. Don't we have a helmet law?
Oh, we do, but by vetoing the non-helmet law.
That's been repealed?
It was on their desk.
Really?
Yeah, they were repealing the helmet law. It's
you know,
news.
This is amazing. Well, there's a number of reasons that there was a helmet law. I mean, when I used to ride a motorcycle, there weren't helmet laws, and I always wore one, and I'm only here today because I wore a helmet. The many ways it was pushed by the insurance companies that know that riding motorcycles is extraordinarily dangerous activity. In fact, if they repeal the helmet laws, expect your insurance if you've got a motorcycle to go up significantly because the payouts, as is, are enormous for riders. And whoever back then, whenever, you know, they said, okay, because insurance companies and all groups like that obviously have a lot of sway. And at one level, I guess I would say let's be real libertarian about it. If people want to risk their noggins by not wearing a helmet or not wearing leathers or not wearing boots, I mean, you go out west in like New Mexico, you see people riding flip-flop shorts and tank tops, no helmet. I go, whoa, man. Sliding along that road is really going to hurt. You could say it's up to them. Anybody that rides a bike knows the risks. However, this one of these things could be a whole show. And I know some people say that helmets are actually more dangerous and all that, but it's not. I mean, there's no serious science to back that up. But there is an overall cost to the general public. Like, for instance, seatbelts, the same thing. You can say, wait a minute, you know what happens to people in car crashes, and everyone knows you're safer if you have a seatbelt on, but hey, man, if I don't want to have a seatbelt on, why can't I not wear one? Why do I have to go through a check lane that I saw the other day in Royal Oak to make sure you got your seatbelt on? That's partly because the insurance companies want people to get hurt less, not because they give a damn about it. They, like any corporation, only care about money. They want to pay out less, and the safer we are in cars, the less money they pay out. But there is a social cost. If you start having people banged up, you're out of work, you got extraordinary medical costs that sometimes the state has to pay up. So, I don't know. It's
Well, honestly, I just wanted to see how you felt about Mr. DeVos.
Yeah, I think it would be a disaster to have this man in office. Absolutely a disaster. We might as well, I mean, from going from being one of the most liberal states, we'd turn into one of the most far right wing states. That send him back to Grand Rapids is what I say. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Here's Dwayne. Dwayne's in Livonia. Hi, Dwayne. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
Based on your, I want to make a comment in rebuttal to your comment in regards to gay marriage.
Sure.
Just curious with the alternative lifestyles and where exactly should we stop with allowing alternative lifestyles to be allowed to under state law be legally married? Would you allow a member of NAMBLA to marry a 14-year-old boy? Would that be legalized then too? That's an alternative lifestyle.
Well, I think there's a little bit of difference between adults that are fully competent individuals to exercise what is a natural part of human sexuality, in that it appears everywhere and always has, and it's only been these repressive religions that have tried to suppress it. Because you go back into primitive tribes, and there's homosexuality that occur. I actually don't care too much what other consenting adults do. When you start having relations that are based on power, that is an adult and a child, that's something different. Children need to be protected by laws. But you can't show me, and it's a terrible argument, for one thing, to have any comparison between that. Once long ago, someone said, yeah, well, what if somebody wanted to marry their dog? Well, at one level, I couldn't care less whether anyone married their dog. But again, it's such an invidious and insulting comparison between when I think of the gay men and women that I know that have had long-term commitments to one another, that are stable members of our communities and represent all sorts of public figures. To characterize them in that way doesn't make a bit of sense. How is the body politic or society or our culture hurt by the men and the women that I know that live with one another as couples being recognized as a marriage? How are we hurt?
Well, where would the future generations come from?
Well, it'll be up to you and me, Dwayne. How's that? We'll take care of that. There's too many damn people in the world as there is, in case you haven't noticed, and we're almost got it to the tipping point. I think that the greatest expression of human sexuality is based on that drive for reproduction, so you needn't worry about it.
But on the flip side, with reproduction, by stifling reproduction, you're stifled, just like in Japan.
But how are we stifling it? These people are gay. They're not interested in reproduction. I'm not interested in reproduction. What's any difference between my wife and I, who've never had any children, and a gay couple? I mean, we made a conscious decision not to reproduce. Is there something wrong with us?
If they're not interested in reproduction, then why are they adopting children?
Well, listen, they want to raise children, and they're doing children a favor. But you can't limit, you won't answer my question. Where is the harm being done, since we have enough people to reproduce, to the extent that we need foster parents, of which they are filling part of the process? I know two women, for instance, one of them who had twice has had artificial insemination. She bore two children, yet two women live together. What's that book? Somebody or other has two mommies. They're business women. They have this wonderful home. They have these two beautiful daughters. I know heterosexual marriages with children that are frightful. And I'm sure you do. That, I mean, 50% of all first-time heterosexual marriages end in divorce. So there's spousal abuse, child abuse, and all of that is like negligible among gay couples. So I think maybe we ought to say heterosexual couples shouldn't be able to marry.
Well,
I'm being facetious.
Well, right.
Wait, but before we go, tell me what harm comes to you or me or our community or our nation if the state recognizes these couplings that already occur. I mean, I know fairly well, like four or five gay couples,
insurance costs rise.
Well, I don't know that insurance costs will rise, but to the extent that they do, if we have to recognize people's humanity, I'm willing to do it. How about this? How about if we immediately get out of Iraq, take all that money that we've been flushing down the drain or flushing into the pockets of Cheney's pals in Halliburton and the rest of them, and use that to support our neighborhoods? So if the two men that I'm thinking of and the two women that I'm thinking of that live pretty close to me that I see almost every day as my wife and I walk our dog, if it means that my overall insurance is going to go up a few bucks, that's fine. I'd rather have that than continue to give it to Cheney's pals. Got to go. That's it. So we got to put it in our Constitution that gays can't marry because it's going to cost us a little more for insurance. That's really weak, isn't it? I mean, isn't that just weak beyond belief? Man, I wish I could talk about this more. Got to go. I'm sorry to leave so many of you hanging. We'll do it again next week for sure. And then I'm going to be off the week after that and maybe the 4th of July holiday as well. So, I'm going to miss doing this. But, hey, I'll be back next week.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla, holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks.
WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Morning. Thank you for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. If you've watched the news today, the day we are recording this interview, you know that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been killed by a 500-pound bomb. He's the man who spearheaded much of the insurgency that was the suicide bombings, the beheadings, not the general insurgency. Certainly he's not the general of that. But he played a role in all of this, and there is some celebration in Iraq, much celebration in Washington. And we're going to examine this morning with a guest who makes a return appearance on the Peter Werby Show the whole question, are we safer now? Joining me is William D. Hartung, and Bill Hartung is the President's Fellow at the New School for Social Research at the World Policy Institute. He's the founder and director of the Institute's ARMS Project, and he has numerous books out. I believe the last one we spoke to him about was How Much Are You Making on the War, Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, published by Nation Books. Bill Hartung, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, it's just the news of al-Zarqawi's death, assuming that, in fact, it has been identified correctly, is just hours old. So is it too early to figure out what this all means? There's great joy, of course, in Washington.
Well, I think for sure we can say that Zarqawi was as much a symbol of anti-U.S. Terrorism as he was sort of a mastermind. I mean, a lot of the al-Qaeda-related groups are autonomous now. They don't all sort of march to the same drummer. They've got the same ideology. They use some of the same tactics. But I don't think eliminating one person is going to, unfortunately, change their ability to carry out attacks, particularly in Iraq, where our soldiers are in a very difficult situation.
You know, I was thinking of the 1930s when there were all these outlaws, Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger, and they were always portrayed as sort of representing the crime of the era and the lawlessness. Is Zarqawi in many ways, even though he's carried, like those other criminals I mentioned, carried out their own deed, so has he, but it's almost like he's the Fu Manchu of whenever that was, the teens or the 20s, that one of the masterminds of it all. Did he occupy that role?
Well, I think he was more of the public face of that movement than the single sort of, you know, brains behind it. And, you know, I think that's that responsibility is sort of shared out. There's plenty of strategists, unfortunately plenty of people willing to sacrifice themselves as suicide bombers. So in that sense, you know, there may be some short-term effect, but it could go the other way. I mean, they could decide they've got to step up the bombings to show that they can operate without them. So, you know, I think we'll have to wait and see about that.
Well, there were a number of them today following the death in forswearing vengeance and may a thousand Zarqawis arise. Will this have, I mean, pretty hard to really assess this, isn't it, a galvanizing effect on the people that remain, or will it be demoralizing? Maybe, I don't know, it's a hard one to answer, particularly when it's just a couple hours old.
Well, a lot of the other big turning points, like when Saddam Hussein was captured, like when they had the first provisional government, basically attacks were stepped up after those events. And I think it was partly for the resistance and the terror groups and so forth to show that they could still operate, that these events were not going to deter them from carrying on their activities and so forth. So I think that might be the more likely outcome, but it depends, on there is a factor of morale which may kick in, but I imagine that would be a short-term thing.
Well, al-Qaeda in Iraq released a statement today, pardon me, saying, "We want to give you the joyous news of the martyrdom of the Mujahid Sheikh Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The death of our leaders is life for us. It will only increase our persistence in continuing holy war so that the word of God will be supreme." So we don't really know whether that's whistling in the dark, do we?
No, I think there's a real mixture in these groups of people who are true believers in that sort of rhetoric, people who are in it for political reasons, but don't buy the whole religious superstructure. There's even some people who are, you know, sort of, it's a way to get paid, sort of like a drug runner or something. So, I think different elements of his group will react in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, you mentioned the word mastermind. Does it take a mastermind to carry these events out? It seems to me that anyone with the persistence, the words in there that they use, with persistence, could carry out a campaign of terror if you didn't care anything about the people you could potentially injure and didn't care about losing your own life.
Well, yes. I mean, in Iraq especially, they're basically doing suicide bombings. There's some improvised explosive devices that have killed a lot of our troops. But they're not trying to do a big, complex operation like was done against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So in that sense, there's no sort of big, you know, intellectual kind of content to that. As long as there's people willing to die, it doesn't take that much to strap the explosives on them and send them on their way.
And is there any reason to believe, or let me put it another way, is there a reason to believe that this is all coordinated? Is there an Al-Qaeda, a center, that sends out orders to its manifold cells saying, do this, do that? I mean, it's a little hard for me to believe that somehow I'm forgetting his name, as we call him, Osama bin Forgotten, is sending out orders via some method and telling people. Or is it just pretty much dispersed and decentralized?
I think even more so than before the attacks in Afghanistan, it's kind of this loose network of groups, and they all have the same, more or less the same ideology. They may be inspired in some ways by bin Laden, but they're sort of self-sufficient. You know, they can choose when to attack. They've got their own resources. And so it's a very loose kind of connection. It's not like Al-Qaeda Central and you got to call them up and get clearance before you can do one of these things.
William Hartung is my guest in the Peter Werbe Show. He's the president's fellow at the New School for Social Research at the World Policy Institute in New York City. And we're talking about, we haven't gotten really to the question, are we safer yet? Well, all of a sudden, a chill, particularly those of us here in Michigan, got quite a chill, because 200 miles away, about 17 men are accused of plotting a pretty horrendous terrorist act about 200 miles from here. Yet nothing has happened in this country since September 11, 2001. Any sense, Bill Hartung, whether we're lucky or is police work really on the ball?
I think there's some luck involved. I think people, you know, police and otherwise, are more wary, more alert. It's probably a little harder to surprise us than that first time. And since the Al-Qaeda network is kind of broken up into these little cells all over the place, it seems like they're hitting other countries, other targets, probably while they try to figure out a way to hit the U.S. So they may also want to do something spectacular and catastrophic here that, you know, it's sort of hard to follow the horrendous acts they did on September 11th. So they might try, you know, be trying to do or attempt to do something large and with lots of casualties, as opposed to a smaller attack that they probably could carry out if they wanted to, a suicide bombing or something like that.
No, that's ominous sounding. I mean, we, of course, one of the words that that no one likes to hear when we start thinking about these kind of things is nuclear. Whether or not these loose nukes that are all around the world, whether the capacity exists to get them into the country, whether a detonation is possible, is any sense whether that is within the realm of possibility in this country?
Well, I think it's a long shot, but it's not impossible. There's probably two ways at it. Some sort of Al-Qaeda cell was already in the country and got hold of materials, they could probably make a crude bomb, and then they'd already be here. They wouldn't have to get through customs or ports or anything. The other thing is probably to try to get nuclear materials from Russia, which hasn't, enough leftover material to make tens of thousands of bombs. And although the U.S. has been helping to pay the cost of securing those materials and destroying those weapons, they've actually achieved less in the years since September 11th than was achieved before. So there's no sense of urgency in terms of the money being spent, the political will being exercised by the Bush administration on this particular problem, as opposed to, say, the war in Iraq, where they claimed it was going to be about weapons of mass destruction, but it clearly wasn't. They could take probably a couple weeks worth of what the Iraq war is costing and spend enough money that they could secure all the materials in Russia in 3 or 4 years instead of a dozen or more, which is the way things are heading now. So, I think as long as those materials are out there, as long as those weapons have not been secured, as long as there's research reactors which haven't been dealt with, there's always the possibility that an Al-Qaeda type group could get either a nuclear weapon or at least a dirty bomb, which is, a conventional explosive that spreads radiation all over the place. So I think, you know, it's still a low probability, but it would be so catastrophic that, we should be doing everything possible to make sure that it can't happen.
It almost seems like we're not doing hardly anything. We're engaged with Iran, fearful of them perhaps having the capacity to create a nuclear weapon 5 to 10 years down the line, when there is so much nuclear material spread around the old Soviet Union. That is truly frightening. And it seems like a couple of times when there could have been an opportunity to reduce at least the nuclear weaponry, that the Bush administration seemed to have no interest in it whatsoever.
Well, no, they have this what they call the Strategic Offensive Reduction Treaty, which spells SORT, because it's sort of like a treaty, except they don't have to get rid of any of the weapons. You know, they're going to supposedly take them off deployment, but they're going to keep them, you know, so they can redeploy them whenever they want. So it's not really a reduction in nuclear weapons. It's just kind of rearranging the way that they deploy and organize them. And so that's a big problem, because they really should have done a treaty that reduced and destroyed the weapons and got them down to as low a level as possible, because then there would be some sort of credibility in going to a country like Iran and saying, you know, we're reducing, we're going to get rid of our nuclear weapons, we're going to lean even on, sacrosanct allies like Israel, who have a few hundred nuclear weapons, and so you won't have to worry about, you know, having to balance other countries that might threaten you with nuclear weapons. And it's as long as the U.S. and Russia are basically holding thousands and tens of thousands of these things, you know, it's very hard to make any kind of moral or even strategic argument of why a country like Iran should not pursue them.
And I was thinking strategically, particularly Russia, which never seems like a particularly stable country. One could imagine a far right-wing nationalist party coming to power in Russia, of which many exist, that see the United States still as the enemy of Russia and Europe, and suddenly beginning belligerency again.
That's the problem, you know, that really they should get rid of as many of these weapons now as they can while there's still decent relationships between the U.S. and Russia. There's already been a cooling because of, Putin's clampdown on the press and his manipulation of the political system and so forth. But there's still, you know, at least cordial relations between the Bush administration and the Putin government. And I think that's the time when they should strike to get rid of these weapons, not just sort of hope that things will always be this way and that they'll always have this opportunity.
Now, Bill Hartung, your last book, and I say I believe we talked about it on the air, how much are you making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration? Hundreds of billions of dollars are being spent on war preparation. Are we safer? At one point, I know, this goes through my mind all the time, one of the insurgents said he likes to fight barefoot. He had an AK-47 and some loose clothing on, and he was barefoot. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, we're spending almost $500 billion a year. Are we getting bad analogy? I guess a bang for our buck.
Well, they're building the wrong things. You know, they're building things like the F-22 fighter plane, which was supposed to go up against a Soviet plane that was never built, and it cost $200 to $300 million per copy. They're building attack submarines that were supposed to follow the Soviet Navy around, and Russia really doesn't have submarines anymore, other than ones that are rusting in their ports. They're building the Osprey, which is sort of part aircraft, part helicopter, even though it's crashed in tests and killed about 30 or so of our Marines. So these weapons are, even before you count what companies are making from supplying the war effort, and they are, they had the right kind of weaponry to overthrow a government. They had the bombs, they had the tanks, they also had an Iraqi army that wasn't terribly up for sacrificing its lives for Saddam. But then now that they're occupying the place, a lot of this big equipment really doesn't help them, because they don't know who's an insurgent and who isn't. They don't know the terrain of the country. A lot of what they're unfortunately being killed with are quite simple devices where they can just hook up a cell phone with some artillery shell they found in the huge tons of weapon stocks that Saddam's army left over. So it's really, I mean, it's sort of akin to what happened in Vietnam where the other side had no air force, it had no, you know, highly sophisticated equipment, but it knew the terrain, it was motivated, and a lot of the high-tech U.S. stuff just didn't serve the purpose of really trying to win the conflict. So, you know, I think it would be probably more valuable if they were training the troops in peacekeeping, peace operations, language and cultures of different countries, if there was more diplomacy and economic aid before they turned to, you know, military interventions. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in the case of Iraq, there was no real reason to be there. I mean, you know, the guy was a dictator, yes, but there's dictators all over the world. And he his worst crimes had been done in the 80s when he was a friend of the Reagan administration. So, you know, if you're going to put your troops in harm's way with equipment, a lot of which has been built really to serve defense contractors and not to serve the troops, then you're doing them a huge disservice, not to mention risking our security.
Well, Bill Hartung, you actually anticipated my next question was, this doesn't seem to be so much preparation for war or for defense, but part of the economy. And we often talk about, you know, the defense contractors or the, well, I mean, actually, that Eisenhower's phrase about the military-industrial complex, that's a little more systemic in terms of its definition. But I was just reading in the New York Times business section the other day, which I'm sure you saw as well, and I can't remember the plane, but it was an enormous transport plane that they don't need, that they keep building. And you made the C something or other. Did you happen to see that?
Yes.
Okay. And what struck me in there, actually, you know, I printed it out. I should have brought it because I would have been able to speak a little better about it. But when you got down into the article, they're talking about thousands of jobs that are wrapped up in this. So it's we're talking about the economy here that in a large part is based on the manufacture of war material.
Well, what they've done is, you know, they place the factories very strategically, you know, so they put them in the districts and states of people who dominate the armed services and appropriations committees. Of course, they have support of the unions because they're unionized jobs in manufacturing, which are, you know, harder and harder to come by these days. And even though it's, I mean, it's not the, you know, it doesn't predominate in our economy, but it's very important to those particular areas, and a huge amount of research and development is done through the Pentagon, which gives them a hold in some cases on our universities, and of course they sponsor all kinds of studies about how threatening the world is, and of course that's what they're looking to hear, and so that's what the people who do the studies tell us. So it's kind of a combination of the money and the kind of fear factor that they can turn on and off, and the way they can kind of shape the public's perception of how threatening is the world, you know, throwing money around for that purpose. So it's you know, it's really a lot what Eisenhower was talking about. It's maybe a little different. It's a little more diversified now because you've got sort of the countries that make the weapons that kill people, the Lockheed Martins and the Northrop Grummans and so forth. You've got the sort of rebuilders who go in after the war and make money on that, like Halliburton. And then you've got the private military companies, which actually are involved in training and security and things that are, you know, right up to and even, you know, on the battlefield. So it's they're sort of, you know, corporate mercenaries, essentially. So you've got all these different ways to make money, you know, while the war is being fought, after the war is done, during various kinds of missions that are considered short of war. There's a company for each of those circumstances that's going to cash in some way.
Well, taxes are, to some extent, a wealth transfer. So we work, we get a portion of it taken out, and could either come back. I was struck by the price of that one plane you mentioned, the $200 million. One and a half of those, and boom, Detroit is out of debt. Or they've just announced that in Detroit they're going to raise some water rates, and essentially for poor people, 30%, which is an extraordinary hit on people if your income is low. So we can either take this money into the general pot and bring it back in goods and services to us, or it can go into the F-whatevers.
Well, exactly. And then, of course, the wars are a huge expense. The Pentagon gets about $440 billion a year before you count the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the money for the wars, which they call, you know, quote-unquote emergency spending, is another 160 or so. So we're talking $600 billion a year, which could do a lot to rebuild our cities, to have decent nutrition programs, to improve schools. All these things are basically getting squeezed, and it's made worse by the fact that you've got these huge Bush tax cuts. So revenue's disappearing from the federal budget, and then what's left, a bigger and bigger share, is going to the Pentagon and their contractors. So pretty much anything else that government normally does is feeling it, and it's going to feel it, I think, a lot harder now that Bush has pretty much done as much as he can do, at least I'm thinking he is, on the tax cut front.
Well, war spending, as you said, we produce the weapons of war. They destroy a country like Iraq, then Bechtel and Halliburton get to rebuild it. So, yeah, that's all generated within the economy. So it is creating jobs. Is it a way to have a good economic system?
Well, I think it's kind of diminishing returns over time, because the weapons have higher technical content, fewer jobs per dollar. Even when they export weapons, a lot of times the assembly is done overseas. Pretty much anything else you would spend it on would create more jobs, but the problem is, there's a big resistance in certain parts of the country to spending a lot of money on social programs and public investment and so forth. That's sort of viewed as, you know, creeping socialism or something. Whereas when they spend equal or greater amounts on the Pentagon, somehow that's consistent with our free market system. So I think there's really kind of a cultural mindset that has to change, and talking about, as Eisenhower did, that we need a strong, vibrant economy is one of the most important things that allows us to defend the country. And in some cases, although it creates jobs, the military can be kind of a drag on the economy. A lot of the research they do is done in secret. It's not well disseminated to other parts of the scientific community and industry and so forth. So it's given the huge amounts of money involved, it certainly has a big economic impact, but that money could be better invested if we had the political will to do that.
Mm-hmm. Bill Hartung, here's a challenge. In 30 seconds, how could we become more safer? Should we start by disengaging from Iraq?
Well, I think we need to get out of Iraq. I think we need to rebuild our alliances so that we have better intelligence. I think we need to start working on things like peace between Israel and Palestine, giving aid around the world instead of being viewed as a country that comes behind the barrel of a gun. I think all those kinds of things would be a huge improvement over this kind of militarized approach to dealing with terrorism.
Well, thank you so much. William Hartung is the President's Fellow at the New School for Social Research at the World Policy Institute in New York City. He's been my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Do we have a website? I should have asked you this before. Do we have a website we can send people to?
Yes, it's www.worldpolicy.org.
All right, and I'll have a link to that on my site, peterwerbe.com. Bill Hartung, as usual, thanks for being my guest on the show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Hi, thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you as usual. I have a book here, extraordinarily interesting. Almost, this is an odd sensation for me. The subject matter is such it almost embarrasses me to bring it to public attention. But if we're, what's that old, there's an old phrase about something, if you don't learn from the past, you're condemned to relive it. And we ought to look at ourselves and our nation and our culture square in the face and see what comes up. The book is called Sundown Towns. That's right, sundown, like when the sun goes down. Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. And my guest is James Lowen. Jim Lowen last was on this show about 10 years ago. He wrote an extraordinary book called Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Jim Lowen, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show, even though it's been a while.
It has, and I'm happy to be back.
tell us, well, maybe we could begin by what is on the cover of your book, Sundown Towns. It said, Whites Only Within City Limits After Dark. And one would think, oh, what an offensive sign. I'm sure glad this is just, you know, maybe a little teeny minuscule part of American history and ain't no more. But tell us about the book and how this sign figures in.
Sure. It's interesting. That sign is from a town in Connecticut. And one of the things that's interesting about that is I have at least 150, probably 200 solid reports in oral history of signs in the Midwest, signs in Oregon, California, the Plain States, the Appalachians, and the Ozarks. And typically, sundown town signs were offensive. They said, quote, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, for instance, which did have such a sign. And this sign from Connecticut is much more polite, and the term sundown town wasn't used in New England and in the Northeast, but it sure was used in Michigan and in the Midwest and all the other places I mentioned. See, they're nicer in Connecticut, but the policy is the same. Whites only in the city limits after dark.
Now, that's just amazing. Now, if you're talking about small towns in the Midwest or small towns here in Michigan, where did these African-American people live that they had to leave a particular venue? Where?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first started thinking about this, I kind of had the misconception that when black folks came north, they kind of just naturally went to Detroit and Chicago and my hometown of Decatur, Illinois, which is an industrialized city of about 80,000. It never occurred to me that actually, coming from rural areas in the South, many of them, and from small towns, they in fact went to small towns, but they did. Between 1863 and 1890, black folks went everywhere in this country. They went to every county in Indiana but one. They went to every county in Montana but one. They were in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and so on. But then, between 1890 and 1940, they get driven out of county after county, of town after town. There's little race riots. There's little freeze-outs. People are just hostile. So, for instance, I'll just pick one at random. In Pinckneyville, Illinois, there was a black church. There was a segregated and separate, but nevertheless, a black school and a little black neighborhood. This area is now known today as the Black Hills. And we're not talking about, you know, South Dakota. We're talking about a neighborhood that used to be black people. And in 1928, probably, I haven't even got the date for sure, but that's probably when it was, the black folks were raided out of town, and there hasn't been a black couple in Pinckneyville since.
I'm sorry, they were what? They were what out of town, did you say?
Well,
what was the verb? I didn't.
I said raided. A raid, you know, a raid occurred, called them, caused them to leave. It's interesting. Sometimes people don't even remember the story. In Pinckneyville, I get several different stories. One was that all the blacks were loaded on a bus and sent to East St. Louis. Another, which I think is somewhat more plausible, is that one African American was lynched from a tree at the courthouse, and in the aftermath, the rest of the black community, seeing that no justice was going to be done to that person and being threatened themselves, fled on their own.
Now, this, of course, Jim Lowen, one would associate activity like this with the South, but increasingly, I was trying to remember just recently there was some lynching in Minnesota that has come to public attention.
That was in Duluth, and that's actually one of the famous lynching photos, because it was a multiple lynching. It's with three bodies hanging, and this photo was often used to illustrate lynchings in America, but it's usually there's usually no caption that tells that it's from Duluth, and of course Duluth is almost in Canada.
Sure.
Let me say one other thing about that, since you brought it up. In the aftermath of that lynching, which was of three circus workers who were accused of rape, and I think it's pretty well established that they didn't do it, but in the aftermath of that, Superior, Wisconsin, which adjoins Duluth and is a big city in northern Wisconsin, drove out its black population and I think became a sundown town. I'm not dead sure of that because there's so much research to do all across the United States, so many different towns.
Well, at the opening to the show, I said this almost embarrassed me. I mean, I almost had the feeling, of course, I would never give in to this impulse, that we have come, you know, we have made great strides, still a long way to go, but bringing up an ugly past like this almost makes me shudder, particularly when we learn it wasn't just the bad old Southland, but our neighbors up here in the North and in the Midwest. What's the value as an historian do you see in us confronting this and you writing this fairly large book around over 500 pages?
Well, you've got actually two questions on the burner there. Let me first of all just underscore what you said. Sundown towns are not a Southern phenomenon. I spent a lot of time, I lived in Mississippi for 8 years, and I spent a lot of time trying to nail down every last sundown town in Mississippi, and I found six. Now, when I first started to do this research, I thought that I would find 10 sundown towns in Illinois. That was my home state, and I thought I'd do more research there than in any other single state. So I expected to find maybe 10 in Illinois and maybe 50 across the country. But to my amazement, I found 472 in Illinois alone, which translates into maybe 10,000 across the country, and many, many in Michigan. Almost all Detroit suburbs were sundown towns, and so was Owosso, and so was Ironwood up in the Upper Peninsula, and probably a whole host of other towns that I haven't really nailed down yet.
When you say there's sundown towns, and you talked like on the cover of your book that's published by the New Press, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism with its whites only within city limits after dark sign on the cover, are you talking about that cities that explicitly had signs like that or ones where that was accepted policy?
Oh, no, not necessarily with signs.
Okay.
But it was certainly the policy. For instance, in Dearborn, African Americans could work in Dearborn, and of course, the largest single Ford plant for many years was in Dearborn, and Ford did employ black folks, but they couldn't live in Dearborn. They couldn't even rent in Dearborn, and the mayor of Dearborn, Mayor Orville Hubbard, made that clear. But Dearborn is pretty famous, but a lot of people don't realize that Dearborn was actually hospitable compared to, say, Wyandotte, which used repeated little race riots to drive out any blacks who made the mistake of spending the night and trying to live in Wyandotte. And other sundown suburbs would include Gros Eel and, of course, all five Grosse Pointes, Livonia, Warren, just a whole host of them. I think, actually, Detroit has more sundown suburbs, even than Chicago, and even than L.A., those would be the runners-up.
That would mean that if you're a black person and driving through Grosse Pointe or Warren or something like that back when this was in force, would this be something that the police would immediately intervene? I mean, I know...
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
This DWB, you know, driving while black, is not so new. I have reports of it even back in the 1920s. And I have interesting reports of a white woman, for instance, a resident of Vandalia, Illinois. Now, Vandalia is a former capital of the state of Illinois, and it's the western terminus of the National Road, our first great highway. Vandalia was a sundown town up until certainly 1995, possibly in the late 1990s. It collapsed and now allows blacks to live there. We think so. But anyway, up until about the late 90s, if you were black and you were driving around in Vandalia, you would get followed and you would get questioned. You know, they would actually pull you over and question. And this is told to me by a white woman who endured it because she was in a car driven by a black person.
Certainly, I've heard about that from my youth. I remember there was a famous case where an African-American judge of the city of Detroit was pulled over by the police in one of these, I guess, sundown towns, and he didn't let on that he was, a judge. He just kind of let it play out as though he was an average person of African descent. And then, of course, you know, when they found out that, in fact, he was a judge.
Oops, they made a mistake.
Yeah, and they apologized and all of that. You know, when I think of, I mean, certainly slavery was about economics. In other words, you had a workforce that you didn't have to compensate with regular wages once you'd made the purchase.
Right.
And then after Reconstruction in the 1880s onward, it was about economic domination. It was about political control with a lot of pathology mixed in. What was it, was this the case in all these sundown towns as well? Why did they do this?
Well, it's interesting because it isn't always for immediate economic gain. Although sometimes it is. I mean, for instance, when the people got driven from Pinckneyville, well, suddenly there's a bunch of empty houses, aren't there? And white folks ended up in those houses. And if, in fact, blacks got paid for them, and I know that actually the black church did get paid because I found the deed for that transfer, and they got paid $100 for their church and church building. Now, admittedly, this was back in 1928, and prices were a lot lower then, but still, $100 for a perfectly sound church building, which by the way then became a white residence for many years, doesn't seem like a whole heck of a lot, you know. And it's a distress sale. You can't really say, nope, that's not enough. I want a bargain, because you're not even allowed in the town at that point, you having been driven out. So there is that kind of immediate economic gain. But I actually have talked with learned of, in some of each, people in some of these sundown towns, for instance, a small town in southern Illinois, this is West Frankfort, and there's a man there who says, well, I don't actually want economic development, because if we have economic development, that means the N-word will come in, and we don't need that. Well, and as a result, West Frankfort hasn't had much economic development, so it's sometimes you do it even against your economic self-interest.
Well, is it what about the level of pathology? Just race hatred as having a convenient scapegoat for all of your frustrations that you can't deal with?
Well, I think people have to realize that between 1890 and 1940, and I have a whole chapter on this in my book, Sundown Towns, this is the period that gave birth. This is the gestation period of most of these sundown towns. Ironwood, Michigan, for instance, I think allowed blacks up until 1890, but then after 1890 at some point, it made a decision to become a sundown town. I think Owosso did the same thing, and so many other towns all across the country except in the South. And I think that this period, 1890 to 1940, was such a regressive period, it's actually becoming known as the nadir of race relations, nadir meaning, of course, low point.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several causes for it. One cause, I sometimes talk about the three I's when I'm talking about the underlying causes. One of them was Indian Wars. That is, here we had given full rights to black folks in the 14th and 15th Amendments in 1868. But we weren't giving full rights to Native Americans. And if we discovered gold on Sioux land, for instance, which we did, well, then we took it, which we couldn't have done if it had been my land or your land. You know, we would have had to deal with you. But we just took it because they were not white. Well, it's very hard to give full rights to black folks who aren't white, but then not to Indians because they aren't white. There's a contradiction there. And another one of the I's was immigrants. These pesky immigrants kept coming in from southern and west and eastern Europe in the 1880s and the 1890s and on, and they kept on voting Democratic. And so the Republicans, who were the good guys on race in the 19th century, the Republicans just got upset with them. Now, there's some reasons why they voted Democratic. Two in particular, the Republicans were moving toward prohibition, and you're just not going to get the Italian vote, you know, by coming out against wine and so on. And second of all, the Democrats were the party of overt white supremacy. And this appealed to immigrants who were competing with black folks for jobs on the wharfs and you know, some other jobs at, toward the bottom of our society. So the Republicans got mad at the Democrats, I mean, at the immigrants, and started saying, well, we're better, meaning we WASPs, we old Americans, we English Americans and German Americans and Western European Americans are better, better even racially, better in intelligence and so on. Well, again, it's impossible to say we're better than you guys, and then meanwhile, blacks should have full rights. They're not inferior. So, and the third eye, just to get it out of the way real quick, was imperialism, which is an ideology from Western Europe, but it washes into America, and we take Hawaii, and we take the Philippines. And so, and at that point, the Republican president, McKinley, says, well, the reason we're taking the Philippines, of course we had to conquer them, is because our little brown brothers are not ready for democracy. Well, that's just straight racism. And the Democrats said, well, what about our little black brothers? And at that point, the Republicans gave up on it, basically.
My guest is James W. Loewen. His new book, published by the New Press, is Sundown Towns, a Hidden Dimension of American Racism. We're talking about these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of towns in America that told people of color, and we should maybe go into that right now, that to get out of town after dark, because although it was primarily leveled against people of African descent, it was also Asians and Jews. Am I correct?
That's true. That's true. Grosse Pointe, for instance, had this infamous point system with no E on that point, no pun intended, in which you could get up to 100 points. And you got points, for instance, by not being swarthy. If they had 10 points for swarthy versus non-swarthy, and if you looked like me, I'm a good Northern European, then you got 10 points. But if you looked kind of dark-skinned or, you know, like a maybe a Southern Italian, you got 1 point or 2 points. Then the same thing happened for religion and so on, whether you spoke with an accent and so on. They actually had a private investigator that checked you out. Well, white Protestants had to get 60 points on that 100-point scale, and then people would show them houses in Grosse Pointe. Jews had to get 80 points, and very few did. So that was straight anti-Semitism, and in many suburbs, there wasn't any point system at all. They just plain wouldn't sell you a house or rent you a house if you were Jewish.
And they also, of course, had racially restrictive covenants where people would, they had deeds, documents that...
And when those cover an entire town, then I pay attention to them.
Yeah.
If they merely cover a neighborhood, well, they don't even get on my radar screen. But some towns actually required them before a neighborhood could file to become part of the town or before housing permits would be given in a new subdivision.
Now, these towns are so not unusual, or so usual, I guess would be a better way to put it, that you list in your book, Sundown Towns, a number of prominent politicians and other people that lived in these cities.
Yeah, we have to realize, I mean, when I discovered that 472 out of the towns in Illinois were Sundown towns, that's a majority of all towns in Illinois. And I think the same thing is true in Indiana and in Oregon and in various other states.
So that would lead to an extraordinary number of prominent people, because most people that are prominent came from at least middle-class families.
Sure. Well, I mean, I looked at the presidents and presidential candidates in the 20th century. Now, of course, there weren't very many Sundown towns in the 19th century, so I didn't look then. But beginning right off the bat with McKinley and the guy he ran against, William Jennings Bryan, both of them were from Sundown towns, Niles, Ohio, and Salem, Illinois. And then moving right down to the present, our present president, George W. Bush, and his vice president, Dick Cheney, were both from the same Sundown town. They both lived for years in Highland Park, Texas, which is a Sundown suburb of Dallas that got its first African-American homeowners just February of last year, after both of those two gentlemen had already moved on to Washington.
Hmm. Now, one of the, I'm wondering what was, I'm getting back to trying to think of this, the behavior of whites that was so restrictive, so prejudicial, so discriminatory, so absolutely violent against a sector of the population that they must have had a beef against them. Either that, like you said, you mentioned the immigrant competition for jobs, or, I mean, the lengths they went to just seems so out of proportion to what they were facing. Somebody, a group of different people.
Yeah, I actually think you can't say that it's necessarily, well, it's not rational, but it became the thing to do. I mean, between 1890 and 1940, we went so racist that I think there was a contagion of sundown towns. So, you know, for instance, one town down the road a piece passed an ordinance. Blacks, you know, no blacks allowed after sundown. Well, haven't we passed? Why haven't we passed one? You know, it just became the good government thing to do.
Boy, well, I'm just reading Beyond Glory by David Margalek. It's the story of the fight between Joe Lewis and Max Schmeling in 1938.
Yes.
And a lot of this is about, obviously, about race relations and Detroit or Joe Lewis. You know, the role that he played at Black Champion.
I wonder, does he mention that many white Americans actually waved Nazi flags at that fight?
I haven't gotten to the end of it yet.
They were on Schmeling's side because he was white.
Yeah, and now wait a minute. Now you did one of those things where I forgot. Oh yeah, yeah. The Nazis couldn't understand why the Americans were protesting against what the Germans were doing against the Jews, because they said we are only doing and have only the same laws that you've had in place against blacks for the longest time, and we support those.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's true. I think the best thing that ever happened to United States race relations was the invention of Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich, because there we finally saw where the logical extension of our policies would bring us, you know. And really, up until then, we were very, very racist. And I make this comment. Everybody knows about the 1936 Berlin Olympics. That's, of course, when Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals and Hitler refused to shake his hand and all that stuff. What we don't really realize, and I talk about it in Sundown Towns, in 1934 and 5, some German cities started putting signs at the edge of town, just like our Sundown Town signs, saying things like, Jews, no Jews allowed after dark. And Hitler made him take them down in the beginning of 1936 because he didn't want Germany to get a bad reputation for this with the Olympics. Now, in 1932, the United States hosted the Olympics. They were in Los Angeles. All kinds of towns in California and elsewhere had exactly these signs at their city limits with regard to blacks. Nobody in Washington, nobody at all at any level, said, take down these signs, it won't look good with the Olympics. So as of 1936, Hitler was actually more humane in a kind of perverse way. Now, of course, the next year, they start exterminating the Jewish population, and I'm not denying that for one moment.
Well, it was a ways, but it wasn't until
and we haven't done that. But as of 1936, Hitler wasn't doing anything that we hadn't done.
Well, Jim Lone, I'm just shocked how fast this conversation has gone by. We learn this terrible chapter in American history that is not 100% over, but most people, at least I would hope so, are on board to understand that that we need to recognize each person by their individual merits and not have any group identity, particularly when it's negative or prejudicial. Are you happy as a historian seeing the trajectory of where we're going? Does it look good?
I think that about half, maybe even more, of all sundown towns have given it up. Many in the 1990s, I mean, quite recently, Dearborn has certainly given it up in the 1990s. I think several of the Grosse Pointe, you know, there's 5 different Grosse Pointe suburbs, I think several of them have really given it up, and I think black folks can now live and be reasonably warmly received in Grosse Pointe.
Well, let me just interrupt you, because we do have a minute or two left.
Okay.
I mean, it seems to me almost impossible that there's any political entity, any governmental entity in the state of Michigan that could still have racial policy.
Well, not officially, of course.
Yeah.
But we still have DWB, you know, and we still have police in various towns that follow black newcomers, and that's official policy, if you will. You know, it's just it would never be admitted. And we still have private white misbehavior. And I have examples of that in my book. I have a whole chapter on enforcement. For example, recently a small town in Arkansas got a new black family, their first black family, at least in many, many, many decades. And the 2 kids went to school on the school bus, and they got beaten up before they ever got to school. And so the family moved. This kind of thing is still happening. So I can even tell you of a number of towns that I think are probably sundown towns as we speak. And we just hope not, but we think they still require some attention.
The book is Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. It's by the award-winning author of Lies, My Teacher Told Me, James W. Lowen, has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Peter Wallenstein, professor of history at Virginia Tech, says a stunning kick-in-the-teeth book, highly recommended on this end. Jim Lowen, thanks again for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
It's been fun. I hope folks will get the book and do something about it.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsor, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Next, here's All My Life on 101 WRIF Detroit.
All my life I've been searching for something, something never comes, never leads to nothing.